This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Joseph L. Pizzo. And Mr. Pizzo, you are in Bend, Oregon, is that correct?
Right, that's correct.
Okay, and I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at the Special Collections Library at Texas Tech University. Sir, if you would, we'll start with some background information on yourself. Where were you born, and when were you born?
I was born 1948, January 1948, in Houston, Texas.
Okay.
And shortly thereafter, we moved to Brownsville, I think, or Crystal City, Texas.
Okay.
And then my dad went back into the military. He'd been in the military during World War II.
Uh-huh.
He didn't like civilian life, so he went back in the military. He went to Okinawa. And so from age about 2 to 5, we lived in Okinawa. And we had a live-in house made, so I learned Japanese. I spoke it fluently while I was there.
Wow.
As well as a little child can.
Right.
And then we moved from there to France and lived on the economy in France. I spoke French fluently.
Okay. How long were you in France?
3 years.
3 years.
We were in Okinawa for 3 years.
Okay. So basically from age 5 to 8 in France.
Right.
Okay.
We came back to the States. We lived in San Antonio until the end of my 11th grade. I went to public high school in San Antonio. And my dad went to Germany, mm-hmm. stationed there, so I wanted to visit him during the summer. Of 65, and I fell in love with a dependent girl, and so I graduated from high school in Germany.
Oh, really? You ended up staying then?
Yeah, my landlord had been captured by the Russians, and they let him go in 1956.
Oh, gosh.
Tiger tank driver, and so we used to talk in his living room about his experience in World War II. I said, you're coming with us. You're going to the war. And they dragged him away, and he ended up being a Tiger tank driver.
Wow.
So he wore black uniforms. The Tiger tank drivers, crewmen wore black uniforms like the squat desk then. Mm-hmm. And the Russians ripped those folks out of the tanks and were shooting them because they thought they were the SWAT SS. They said, no, we're just tankers. We're not the SWAT SS. Don't kill us. So he was in prisoner of war camp until 56.
Wow. Okay. So,
56, I came back to the States.
1966?
Yeah. And okay. I enlisted in the Air Force.
And how old were you in 1966?
18.
18 years old.
Right.
Were you influenced to enlist from your dad's experience, him being in the military?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah,
why?
But I knew I didn't want to be in the Army because I saw a lower quality of people, and I thought they weren't as well trained as technically trained as the Air Force people were.
Okay.
So I enlisted in the Air Force.
Okay.
Mistakenly.
All right. So where did you go for basic training?
I went basic training at Lackland Air Force Base in San Antonio, my hometown.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And then from there, I went to Lowry Air Force Base, Denver, Colorado.
Okay.
Well, hey, I joined the Air Force because I wanted to go back overseas.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, why the Air Force? Why not the Marine Corps? Or why not?
No, I just want to do Marines.
Okay.
But I joined the Air Force, and I get definitely seasick. So I went across the ocean 3 times by rail because I get so seasick. I lost like 20, 30 pounds every time I went across the ocean on ships.
Huh.
So I knew I couldn't be in the Navy
or
in the Marine Corps because I'd get too seasick on a ship.
Right.
I joined the Air Force, and they trained me on the only aircraft that is solely based in the continental United States, which is the F-106
mm-hmm.
Delta Dart, which is sole purpose in life is to shoot down Russian bombers.
Hmm.
That's its sole purpose in life. And I thought, God, I joined the Air Force to go overseas.
Yeah.
I'm stuck here, and I got stationed in Dover, Delaware.
Okay.
And I thought I was going to be there forever.
Well, let's talk about your basic training real quick. What can you say about that? Can you describe that in general to me?
It was pretty just rudimentary basic training. We did some PT. We did went to the rifle range. This was in 1966.
Mm-hmm.
And M16 had been out for quite a while at that point in time. It came out in 61 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And we shot the M1 carbine in basic training instead of the 30 caliber M1 carbine instead of the 5.56 M16.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah. How long were you in basic?
8 weeks.
Okay. Did you feel like you received really good basic training, or was it, how would you rate it?
I would say it was very good basic training.
Okay. What was the most challenging aspect of it?
Probably the PT and trying to learn all the acronyms for the military.
Okay.
The different subjects they were trying to drill into our heads.
Right. What did you see other men experiencing real difficulties with basic training?
Not at all. I don't think there were any difficulties with basic training, really.
Okay. All right.
different. It was just a different, just a different aspect of life.
Right, right.
It was hard to get the routine down, to learn all the different aspects of that of training and life.
Tell me what kind of weapons training you had there in basic.
M1 carbine.
Okay.
The only thing we got to shoot, and that's the only thing. I don't even remember doing any hand-to-hand or anything.
Okay.
Air Force basic.
What was your typical day like there?
We got up at 0:30 in the morning. went to breakfast, came back, and shaved and everything, and showered, whatever we were going to do, and went to class.
Okay. What would you study in class?
I don't recall any of the classes that we had in Air Force basic.
Okay. All right. Did any of your instructors have Vietnam War experience?
I believe most of our TIs did, yeah, our technical instructors.
Did they talk to you about that at all?
Not at all.
Really? Did you guys ask?
I don't recall asking. I wasn't really that concerned about Vietnam in 66.
Right. Okay. How much were you aware at this point of American interaction in involvement in Vietnam at this point?
I think we probably saw it every day on TV. I just don't remember that much about Vietnam at that point in time.
Did you ever think that you might end up there, that you would go?
I thought I probably would if I was in basic training.
Okay.
And then when I got sent to Lowry Air Force Base.
This is your advanced training?
Right. My advanced training. I knew I wouldn't go.
Why?
Because I was being trained to be an electronic technician or weapons control system mechanic on the F-106 fighter interceptor, which is, like I said, its sole purpose in life is to shoot down Russian bombers.
Right, so...
The only place they were going to come was to the United States.
Right, right, okay.
My chances of going to Vietnam were zero.
What was your advanced training like?
It was pretty good. We went through we learned basic electronics initially, then we went into the F-106's system, and my job was to repair the airborne radar, which would lock onto the opposing enemy's bomber.
Mm-hmm.
And I worked on the radar, the fire control computer, which is actually a whole fire control system.
Okay.
Which is the computer, the radar, the infrared detector, which if the radar was jammed, they could lock onto the aircraft with infrared.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And they had two infrared missiles they could launch. The F-106 had two radar missiles, two infrared missiles, and one nuclear rocket.
Wow.
And what they could do is they could fire the nuclear rocket, and it went out to a certain range and just exploded. It could take out a whole flight of Russian bombers.
Hmm.
And as soon as we got fired the nuclear rocket, he would put the thing in reverse, basically, in the other direction, because the shockwave could knock him out of the air, too.
Right, I can imagine. Now, were you mechanically and electronically inclined? How did you get directed into this line of work?
They chose me. I don't know.
From your aptitude test?
From the AFQT, right.
Okay.
Armed Forces Qualifying Test. They chose me to be an electronic technician.
Did you enjoy this kind of work?
I enjoyed the training. And I guess I enjoyed the work. I didn't like Delaware a whole lot. When I got there, it was just too many mosquitoes, too swamp-like,
okay,
too cold.
Okay.
We were working outside constantly.
Right.
On the aircraft, summer, winter, whatever. The plane would be in the air for an hour, come down, and take 6 or 8 hours to repair it.
Right.
And actually, our computer had some tubes in it. That's how old the thing was.
Wow. Now, what kind of weapons training did you receive there? I mean, you're out working with aircraft.
I received no weapons training at Lowry.
Yeah.
No, we were strictly being school trained to fix the F-106.
What was your typical day like?
We get up about 7 o'clock, go to breakfast, come back, shave and everything,
mm-hmm,
and march off to school.
Okay.
As a whole flight of us, about 50 of us, march off to school. At school, we'd separate and be in our individual class. I had, I think, 8 people in my class.
Okay.
F-106.
Okay.
And we were there for roughly about 10 months, I believe.
Were you still longing to travel, get away?
Oh, yes.
Okay.
I thought, I can't wait till this is over. I can maybe go somewhere. I had no idea where I'd be stationed. And they had F-106 squadrons all across. They had in California, mm-hmm. Delaware, New York, Minot, North Dakota, mm-hmm. all across basically the upper portion of the United States.
Okay, and you were there from June 67 to July 69, is that correct?
Right, about that, yes.
Okay.
I came in from leave in 69. I said, don't shut your car off because you're being transferred. I said, what do you mean I'm being transferred? I said, we're putting you on the gunship program going to Vietnam.
Huh.
Said, oh, that's great.
How did you feel when you received that news?
I felt good because I thought, I'm at least going to get out of the States and get to go overseas.
Now, 1969, we're completely, heavily involved in
yes,
the country.
We were.
And
68 was the worst year, though.
Yeah. What did you think about going over there?
Well, let me tell you, I had a part-time job. My uh-huh. good buddy that I went through Lowry with and then got stationed in Dover with, his name was Robbie Jonigan, and he had a part-time job where you could work any hours a day you wanted. You could work from 3 in the morning to 8 in the morning,
right.
or you worked from 4 in the afternoon to 7, or any time you wanted to work, you could work because it was a 24-hour day job.
Okay.
It was dressing the bodies that came back from Vietnam in the mortuary.
Right.
Everyone who had lived east of Mississippi came through our mortuary in Dover, Delaware.
Every one of them?
Everyone who had lived east of Mississippi.
Wow.
It was a complete dependence. We had a woman that came through. She died in childbirth in Germany.
Uh-huh.
And she and her infant child came through our mortuary.
Wow.
And we had a family of two. We had two couples, actually. They were in a Volkswagen Beetle on the Autobahn, and a truck fell over on them and crushed their Beetle down to, 4 inches off the ground, I guess.
Right.
And they came through our mortuary, too. But any civilian who lived east of Mississippi came through our mortuary.
Okay.
Also.
Now, you got this job through your friend?
Well, he just said, come on down, you can work there anytime you want to. I thought, well, that's a great deal. If I work in swing shifts, I can get up at midnight,
uh-huh.
go to work in the mortuary for 4 or 5 hours, and go home, go to bed, and come back to work at 3 or 4 in the afternoon.
Okay, so you got paid for this?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. I was paid for it.
Okay.
I don't remember. It was nothing. It was like $3.50 an hour or something.
Right.
But we had from 50 to 75 bodies a day come through our mortuary.
What was your job there?
Dressing the bodies.
Dress the bodies.
We'd take another. We'd go down to the flight line
mm-hmm.
and pick them up off out of a hangar. They'd be a bunch of shipping caskets, these metal silver shipping caskets,
mm-hmm.
aluminum-colored shipping caskets. We'd pick them up off the flight line, put them in a truck, and take them back to the mortuary. And offload them, and then take them into the actual mortuary room and open up the shipping casket. They were in a big plastic bag. We put them up on the table, cut the plastic bag off of them, and their hands were in gauze. I guess they wouldn't. Their wrists were in gauze, so they wouldn't get bruised up. And we cut the gauze off of them and start putting clothes on them. We put their socks on them, their underwear, their T-shirt, then their uniform shirt, then uniform jacket, and uniform pants, and socks.
And this is all clothing supplied by the military?
Yes.
Okay. And
we had rooms full of every kind of uniform you can imagine. We had Air Force, Navy, Marine, everything. Hmm. And I saw, like, 9 Air Force people come through the mortuary in the time I worked there from, I guess I was there, 68, 69.
Did they arrive with uniforms on?
Oh, no, they arrived nude.
Okay.
They were nude in a plastic bag.
Okay.
They'd gotten embalmed in Vietnam.
Okay.
If they came from Vietnam. The people who came from Germany were embalmed in Germany.
Okay. So you were able to see some of the wounds from Vietnam.
Yes. Yeah, so we had one guy that came through, and he was running away from whatever, or he was moving the direction away from whatever got him.
Right.
He had 102 holes in the back of his body from the top of his head to his heels. And it was just like, junk, just rocks and nails and
mm-hmm.
just junk stuff they put into a homemade bomb and
right.
killed him with that.
Huh. Were you okay doing this kind of work?
I mean, it was like working on mannequins, basically.
Huh. Okay.
Now, I only worked in viewable. I worked in the viewable room where the people were pretty much one piece.
Okay.
My friend Robbie, who got me the job, worked at non-view, where there were just arms and legs and pieces of people. I could not do that.
Right.
It was just too, it had been too stressful for me.
Right. Okay.
But, I worked, like I said, these were pretty much whole people. We had one guy who was an E-4 who jumped out of a helicopter. He was, I guess, an airborne person or air mobile. And he jumped up as he went out of the helicopter and took off about 1 inch of his skull. Sliced it off really smoothly. And you can't have any of your brain removed with, you know, after you died.
Right.
He was dead, and he had just, you know, like a quarter inch of his top of his skull sliced off, and his head was wrapped in gauze. He put him in his uniform, too, and shipped him off to his loved ones.
Okay.
We had a Marine come through. He was probably about 56 years old,
uh-huh.
And he was a command sergeant major. He had service chevrons from his wrist to his elbow, and then he had his, being a command sergeant major, he had stripes from his elbow up to his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
He had basically stripes all the way from his wrist to his shoulder.
Right.
And we had an E-5 who worked there with us. And yeah, because after the Marine command sergeant major was dressed, he walked up to him, patted him on the chest, said, "They got you, didn't they, Sarge?" And this guy was jealous of this sergeant major.
Huh. Jealous of that he was dead, or jealous of this?
That he was hit some years, successful years in the military.
Okay. Wow.
He was command sergeant major.
So you had write-ups on how they got killed?
Yes, we did. We had a sheet that told us what happened to them.
Okay, all right. That's very interesting work.
It was really fascinating. We had one guy that was shot up by his clavicle, just by the collarbone.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, how could this guy die from being shot right there? Turned out it hit his shoulder blade in the back, his scapula, and went down through his heart and lungs, ricocheted.
Wow.
Or he would have, if it just got through his shoulder, would have been fine, but actually ricocheted off his shoulder blade and went through his heart and killed him.
Now, how long did you do this work?
For about 6 months to a year, I believe.
Okay. And it was there in Dover where you received your orders that you would be going to Vietnam.
Right.
Okay, and from there you went to Lockbourne?
Yes, which is now Rickenbacker Air Force Base.
Okay,
in Columbus, Ohio.
Right, and you were there for what kind of training?
I was there to be trained on how to repair the fire control system on the C-119K flying boxcar gunship.
Okay, all right.
And this gunship had four miniguns, four 308 caliber or 7.62 miniguns, and two 20-millimeter cannons on it. They fired out of the left side of the aircraft.
Okay.
And I worked on the fire control system, which was the airborne infrared television system,
mm-hmm.
the side-looking radar system, and the starlight scope, which were the targeting devices for those guns.
Okay.
The pilot had an optical sight that any one of those, the starlight scope or the infrared television or the side-looking radar could be inputted to his optical sight to show him where the enemy was and where the good guys were.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you enjoy working on that gunship?
Yes, I did. It rarely broke, and it was an excellent system.
Okay.
Actually, I have pictures of them firing around our base.
Okay.
Ordered slides of them firing.
Right. How long did you do this training?
The training I did for 2 months.
Okay.
And my wife is from Toronto, Canada. The wife I had at that time was from Toronto, Canada.
Now, is this the girl you met in Germany?
No.
Okay.
This is when I met my mother and my stepfather lived in Toronto, Canada.
Okay.
And when I was stationed at Lauer Air Force Base in Denver, I went to visit them in Toronto and met a friend of theirs' daughter.
Uh-huh.
Who was Canadian.
Okay.
Actually, British subjects that live in Canada.
Okay, right.
And I married her.
Okay. And so you were saying you went to visit her? Or she was with you there?
She was
with you in Ohio?
She lived with me in Dover, and then we moved to Ohio.
Okay.
She lived with me there, and then she went to Canada before I got sent to Vietnam.
Okay.
And while she was in Canada, she had a miscarriage, so I went to visit her.
Uh-huh.
Be with her for a while, and in Toronto.
Okay.
And then I went back to Lockbourne and shipped out. I was there for about 2 months, I guess, learning the system.
Okay. Did you feel like you received good or adequate training?
Oh, yes.
What's your
really good training.
Okay. Did they tell you what you would be doing in Vietnam? I mean, you would obviously be repairing and maintaining the power control system on the gunship.
Right. They didn't tell us where we were going to be stationed.
Okay.
And it turns out our main base was at Phan Rang Air Base.
Right.
And then we had several forward operating locations, two in Thailand and about four in Vietnam, all over Vietnam.
Okay. So you left, let's see, I believe, in October 69 for Phan Rang Air Base in Vietnam. How was that flight over for you? Were you anxious? Or?
Oh, yeah. We were on a, I think it was Capital Airways 707.
Was it a civilian flight or a military?
Yes, it was a civilian aircraft, yes.
Okay, but were you guys all in uniform? Or?
Yes.
Okay. What was the mood on the plane?
It was good. We landed in Alaska. Way over, and there was like 14 feet of snow outside.
Uh-huh.
But this is really unusual. And we got to Vietnam, it was like 99 degrees.
Right.
And just all heat. It was just a real quick change from cool to heat.
Mm-hmm. What were you feeling on the flight over?
I was excited about going to Vietnam. I thought I was finally going to be able to do something. I used all my training to help some other citizens of the world to combat communism. That's what I
thought. I wanted to ask you, what did you know of U.S. policy at the time? Did you know exactly why America was in Vietnam and why you were being sent there?
I just thought we were trying to fight communism and to keep the communist threat from conquering the whole world.
Mm-hmm.
Erroneously, I thought that.
Okay.
And we got to Vietnam, and I thought, I'll be able to help these people to have democracy in their country.
Mm-hmm.
I just didn't understand.
And that's not how it turned out?
No.
Okay. We'll get into that later.
Okay.
What was your first impression when you got off the plane of Vietnam?
I thought it was really hot and really humid, but beautiful. We flew over the coastline. We were flying about maybe 20 miles from the coast, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
That rang. It was just incredibly lush, green, beautiful country.
Okay. And you landed there in Phan Rang.
Right.
And that was your...
That was where I was going to be stationed.
That was your home base.
Right.
And how long were you supposed to be there?
For a year.
You had a year to tour duty.
Right.
Okay. All right. And can you describe the living conditions there on the base?
Well, we lived in Quonset huts.
I'm sorry, what kind of huts?
Quonset huts.
Okay.
Yeah. That's what we lived in Okinawa. My family lived, and I lived in.
Okay.
And so it was pretty familiar.
Right.
Living in that kind of a thing. All these were open bays, unfortunately.
Uh-huh.
And with the bunks about, I guess, 3 or 4 feet away from each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we had our foot lockers at the end of the bunks. And we had no formations or anything in Vietnam.
What was your typical day like there?
We'd get up at about 7 o'clock, go shower and shave and everything, and go to breakfast, and then go to our shops to find out how the aircraft were doing. And our shops were air-conditioned.
Okay.
They had to be because of electronics.
Yeah.
And so it was really nice to stay in the shop as long as you could, having to go outside in the 99% humidity weather.
Right.
Go out to the flight line to work on the planes. We had ground power units that hooked up to the aircraft to provide the power as they'd be provided when they were in the air. Mm-hmm. And also had air conditioning units that you hook up to keep the electronics cool.
Okay. Did you have all the supplies you needed to do your work? All the equipment?
I got my tools issued to me at Lockbourne.
Uh-huh.
I took them with me to Vietnam.
Okay.
Right, ready to leave Vietnam, I took them back to supply, and they said, "Oh, we can't take these tools because you weren't issued those here. You were issued those in Lockbourne, so you have them. We don't have any inventory for them, so you can have them." So I got to keep all my tools, which were not that really many, just some ratchets and screwdrivers and things.
Uh-huh. Okay, how many hours a day would you spend working on the gunships?
Probably about three, because it was a brand new system.
Uh-huh.
It was Texas Instruments, I believe, was the contractor that built the system, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was a brand new system, so it rarely broke down. And we also had two tech reps that came over with us from the corporation that built the fire control system.
Mm-hmm.
If we had any questions about anything, we could ask them to help us out with it. Although the system rarely broke down because it was so new.
So you didn't have a lot of repairs.
Unlike the gunship, unlike the F-106 fighter, which is really, it was built in 52, and it was breaking down all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a lot of free time.
Okay. All right.
I used to go to the craft shop and work on leather wallets and things. And we were actually stationed with the Australian 2nd Bomb Squadron.
Okay.
At Phan Rang. And I saw some of the Australians at the craft shop where they were working on wallets. And I said, well, this is great. How do you like Vietnam? And this Australian turned around and looked at me and said, how do you like fucking Vietnam? I said, oh, excuse me. Did me ruffle your feathers there, bud? I just thought, oh, Vietnam was a beautiful place.
I said,
it's really too bad. It's a war going on here. I'd love to be able to come over here and visit.
Right, right. Briefly going back to the gunships, just what were the most common type of repairs that you had to do on that?
Probably working on the infrared television system.
Okay.
We had circuits that would go out. We had to replace, work on the circuitry and repair it.
Okay.
And the radar actually was a transponder. A person on the ground had a transponder. The radar would send out a signal, and it would reflect off the transponder,
mm-hmm.
and it would send the signal back to the aircraft. So unless the Army unit or our Marine unit or Navy unit were on the ground, unless they had a transponder, the radar was worthless because it was strictly a radar that received a signal from the ground when it was activated by the radar in the air.
Right. Okay.
So it didn't break down very often since it wasn't used that much.
Okay.
The most common targeting device we used was the infrared television and the starlight scope.
Okay.
Those were the two things that mainly broke down. And the starlight scope only had two things. It had a battery, an oscillator, well, three things. It had a battery, an oscillator, and the infrared, and the starlight enhancing tube.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing really to break down on that.
Did the gunship have a good reputation as a weapon in combat?
They loved it. Everybody loved it over there.
Yeah.
All the ground troops loved it.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, when I was in officer candidate school in the Army,
mm-hmm.
one of my classmates was talking to him one day. He was telling me he was in Vietnam the same time I was, and his platoon of 30-odd guys, was being tracked by a uniformed NVA battalion of 200 to 500 guys.
Uh-huh.
And they were surrounded at night, and they surrounded them one night, and they thought we're going to die, and they called in one of our gunships.
Uh-huh.
They had to be in the area, and the gunship said, "Don't move." They said, "Right, can't move. We're surrounded
by
200 to 500 guys. We're not moving anywhere."
Yeah.
He said, "He saw the whole jungle lift up in the air and come down flat, and there was nobody alive out there. The gunship made one pass of about 10-15 seconds."
Wow.
And just leveled the whole jungle, turned it to nothing.
Incredible.
It was incredible. So it was interesting to hear someone while I was in OCS who had actually been saved by one of my gunships.
Right.
The computer on the gunship would show where the good guys were as well as where the bad guys were.
Mm-hmm.
When the guns got to where the good guys were, they would stop firing automatically.
Mm-hmm.
They'd pass over the good guys and automatically resume firing when they get to the other side of the good guys. It was all built into the fire control system.
Okay.
Which was really handy. The pilot didn't have to know that he was going to hit the good guys to let off the trigger.
Right.
The pilot fired it from his steering wheel, trigger on his steering wheel in the aircraft.
Were there any experiences with friendly fire there with the gunships? I mean, problems with that?
Yeah, we had one minor problem. A gunship was flying over, I believe it was Cambodia or Laos,
uh-huh.
and a 51 caliber round came from the ground, which was Laotian or Vietnam or Vietnamese or something, I'm not sure what it was,
mm-hmm.
hit the gunship's wing and took off 17 and a half feet of the wing.
Mm-hmm.
So they flew back to base with half a wing.
Wow.
And they were pretty panic-stricken. I only went up in the aircraft to check out the system at altitude.
Uh-huh.
To make sure that the system was working.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times the systems didn't do the same thing on the ground that it did in the air.
Right.
I only went up just occasionally to make sure that that the system was working when it was in the air. I knew I was on the aircraft during actual missions.
You never were?
No, never.
Okay. Okay. So you said you worked on the gunships about 3 hours a day. What did you do with the rest of your time?
Well, I went to the craft shop a lot.
Uh-huh.
I bought a camera. Mm-hmm. I brought a camera with me to Vietnam, and I took pictures constantly. Mm-hmm. We had two, we called them hooch maids, that took care of our shoes and making our beds and everything in our barracks. Mm-hmm. And I took pictures of them and just everything else on the base.
What can you tell me about those ladies?
Well, one of them was 17 years old,
uh-huh.
and she was a high school junior or senior, I think, and her sister was either 19 or 20, mm-hmm. and was a college student.
Okay.
And they had to work. They told me they had to work to make money to keep their to help their family out.
Right.
So that's what they were doing. They was working. And actually, one of my squadron members offered one of them $50 for sex. Mm-hmm. She turned him into the first sergeant. She said, "We're not whores. We're here working because we have to work to support our families."
Wow.
I thought that was really incredible. That, you know, most people think that all of Vietnamese women were just prostitutes.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not so.
Yeah.
There are people that got thrown into their situation and made the best of what they could.
Uh-huh.
When I got stationed at Phu Cat Air Base, I was transferred to one of our four operating locations, which was Phu Cat Air Base. Mm-hmm. We had three gunships I maintained there.
Okay.
We had 18 gunships that went to Vietnam with us, and we lost one or two while we were in Vietnam, but I was transferred to a forward operating location. I had three gunships to maintain there.
This is at Phu Cat.
Phu Cat, right.
Uh-huh.
And the lady that took care of our barracks, there was probably about 45 years old.
Mm-hmm.
She was with her husband, and he was in the Army, and he went on a mission and never came back.
Mm.
It was just really sad to know that's the way it was in Vietnam. What was really unusual is that the Vietnamese Army traveled with their families wherever they went.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd be in camp, and they'd be with their families making, you know, breakfast, lunch, or dinner, whatever. And they'd say, "Okay, guys, we're going off to do a combat." And if the guy came back, he's back with you. He's alive. If he didn't come back, he knew that your husband was gone, I guess. So she took a job on the base, taking care of the barracks, mm-hmm. after he died.
Okay.
Which is just really sad. You know, you think of, you know, different armies taking their families with them on missions, but not the United States Army. We never did that sort of thing.
Right.
It was a really unusual situation. Also, I was out at the dump one day throwing some stuff away. At the dump, we were hauling junk out to throw away that was just no good stuff. And I saw Vietnamese troops at the dump going through our garbage, getting oranges that we had thrown away from the mess hall.
These were Arvin troops?
Yes, Arvin troops were getting food from our dump.
Mm. Wow.
I remember them picking up old oranges. I don't know what else we could throw away. We throw away all kinds of stuff
mm-hmm.
that's still edible,
yeah,
naturally, and they were collecting it for their families.
Huh.
I'm not sure what kind of mm-hmm. Mess facilities they had for their families in their units, but they had to be out there, you know, scrounging for food in our dump.
Right. Did you get to know these women that worked in your barracks?
Just cursory. Like I said, I knew, you know, what their ages were and what they did.
Uh-huh.
They were all really nice people, really nice people. And I thought, since I'm in Vietnam, I don't want them saying, "Let's get rid of this guy in Vietnamese. We don't know what they're saying."
Right.
So I took Vietnamese from an Australian sergeant. We had about just 20 people in our class
uh-huh.
at Phan Rang. And so I wanted to learn Vietnamese if I could. And he said, "Of course you know, chaps. You speak Vietnamese with an Australian accent." He was hilarious. He was so fluent, though, that two guys who were Vietnamese and were in suits, they were selling some kind of supplies to the exchange on Phan Rang, having had their backs to him. He was speaking Vietnamese to a woman in the exchange.
Mm-hmm.
And after about 5 minutes, they happened to turn around and said, "Oh, my God, he's not Vietnamese." They walked over and said, "We have to congratulate you. We thought you were Vietnamese. You speak Vietnamese so fluently."
Wow.
You know, proper pronunciation and everything.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to learn the language?
Yeah, fairly well, yes.
Okay.
And I have, my wife and I go to Portland, and we go to a Vietnamese restaurant in Portland, and I try to speak with what I can remember.
Right.
And I talked to a Vietnamese girl who's probably about, she's about 22, I guess. At this restaurant in Portland, and she said, "I have really good pronunciation.
Okay.
Which makes me feel good that
yeah.
I remember
yeah,
the words.
From 1969. That's...
I think it's probably because I learned Japanese and French that I am able to pick up languages fairly well.
Right, right. That might be true. What else did you do? You said you worked, went to the craft shop. You took
right.
Japanese language courses. What else would you do?
We had USO shows, and we go to some USO shows at night and see them.
Did you see anybody memorable?
No, nobody at all.
Okay.
That I can think of. When I got stationed at Phuket,
uh-huh.
There was myself and another sergeant who were stationed there working on the gunships. Just two of us.
Mm-hmm.
They were maintaining our three, the fire control system, only three aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And we worked so little. We worked out of a Phantom fighter electronics shop.
Mm-hmm.
It was a Phantom fighter wing at Phuket
mm-hmm.
of 40 Phantoms. And we had no support except through their shop, so that's where I worked out of their shop.
Mm-hmm.
And our gunships were so, the systems were so new and so well, made that we worked so little that I worked as a cook in the Airman's Club at Phuket, so I could see all kinds of shows. There was Korean bands and Australian bands and everything else.
Was this volunteer or were you getting paid?
No, I was being paid.
Paid to be a cook, okay.
About $3 an hour, I don't know. And plus all the food I could eat.
Okay.
We cooked shrimp, we cooked steaks. We cooked chicken.
This is basically at the officers' club?
No, NCO club. It was actually enlisted club, not the
okay.
NCO club. Even.
Okay.
The enlisted club. And I thought it was really unusual. I'd cook steaks for people, and I started noticing that all the black people, all the black troops that were there,
uh-huh.
no matter what, their Air Force, Army, Navy, whatever they were, they all wanted their steaks well done.
Huh.
Whereas the white guys, I want it mooing still.
Right.
Least, some of the white guys would say that, but generally, all the black people wonder steaks well done.
Hmm.
I was trying to figure out what is the deal with this, so I started taking notes about this, and I thought, well, that's really unusual that
uh-huh.
all black people want their steaks well done. There's a reason for this, and I couldn't figure out what it was. Unless the reason was, I think later I figured out that they must, when they were growing up, had such poor cuts of meat, they had to have it well done in order to eat it.
Hmm. Okay. Did you ever ask?
I never asked him. I was always there.
Okay. Did you ever encounter any race issues? Either?
Yes. We had a lot of race issues, although my roommate was a black sergeant
uh-huh.
at Phuket.
Okay.
And we had probably about 15 black guys in my unit, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
And there wasn't any problem with them personally, but there was a lot of race problems going on in Vietnam at the time. You hear about lieutenants being fragged
mm-hmm.
by the black troops in the Army. And I really thought we were probably going to have a race riot or something in Vietnam at the time, although I didn't personally see it.
Mm-hmm.
I was out wandering around the base one day, actually off the base. I could actually walk through the fence mm-hmm. and get off the base, which I did on a couple of occasions.
At Phuket?
At Phuket, right.
Was that dangerous?
No, apparently not. I'm still here. I was walking. I was only actually on the base one day. I was taking pictures in this forested area. We had a pond or a lake on the base
mm-hmm.
attached to the base. And there were Vietnamese out there fishing.
Mm-hmm.
Some were using poles, some were using spears. So I took pictures of them. And while I was wandering around, I looked up in a tree, and there was a hand grenade in the yoke of a tree. I thought, oh, my God, somebody has booby-trapped this thing.
Uh-huh.
I'm almost step on the, on the base going to set this thing off. So as I looked, I couldn't see anything attached to it. I just can't see it from this distance. So I crawled up in the tree, and there was a hand grenade. It was round, with a brown baseball hand grenade.
Uh-huh.
I picked it up, climbed down the tree, looked at it. It was fine. It was just somebody had stored it. They probably, some Air Force guy probably bought it from an Army guy, or
uh-huh.
was given it to by an Army guy.
Uh-huh.
He's gonna blow up his lieutenant or whatever. I don't know.
Right.
So I took it to the explosive ordnance disposal,
mm-hmm.
and they don't pull the pins out of it and blow them up. They actually just blow them up
mm-hmm.
without pulling the pin because they assume that. If it happened, is some Viet Cong could have taken the thing and taken the timer, the delay out of it.
Right.
So you pull the pin and let it go to the spoon, and it blows up right there.
Right.
That's
right.
The delay. So they just exploded it.
Okay.
That was the only thing that I saw in a race that I thought was probably race related.
How was that race related?
In that somebody was going to blow up some black guy was going to blow up his white or black officer.
Hmm.
I don't know.
Okay.
That's something I could figure it was going to happen. Someone's going to blow up somebody with this thing.
Right.
But why would they store it up in a tree? It just didn't make any sense to me.
Did you get along well with your roommate there? That was
fine? Yeah, it was fine, although he drank quite a bit. He drank gin a lot. Mm-hmm. And we didn't have so much kind of a conversation.
Right. How much drinking was there on base?
It was quite a bit. As I have a picture, I just don't do alcohol too well.
Uh-huh.
So I probably had maybe 10 beers while I was in Vietnam.
Wow.
I went to the Australian NCO club, mm-hmm, at Phan Rang. And I had, I think, a flag ale and a Foster's ale.
Uh-huh.
And that was about it for me. Two beers, I was done in. So that could be over two different visits to the NCO club, I'm not sure. So I just don't drink too much. Never did.
Right. Your roommate drank a lot. There a lot of other? Was there any abuse? I guess that you saw of alcohol.
I would say he was alcoholic. I would say.
Okay.
I don't remember really any other people drinking that much.
Mm-hmm. How about drugs?
When I got stationed at Phan Rang initially, after I probably was taking the Vietnamese course,
uh-huh,
I thought, I don't want to be here in the barracks. We have a wave attack of Viet Cong or NVA, and me be under my barracks, hiding, they come shoot me.
Uh-huh.
So I volunteered to be an augmentee guard.
Okay.
Actually, be thrown out on the perimeter with bullets and a gun.
Uh-huh.
I could defend myself and my base. And so I was trained as an augmentee. We shot M16s. M60 machine guns,
mm-hmm,
and we had a thing called the M174, mm-hmm, grenade launcher, which fired the 40-millimeter grenade, but it had a canister that had 12 of them in it.
Okay.
And it actually sat on the side of this little grenade launcher. It looked like an old World War II 30 caliber machine gun with a pistol grip, mm-hmm, on the back of it.
Mm-hmm.
It had this big tube, 40-millimeter tube on the front of it, and you set the canister in there, and you fire one for range.
Uh-huh.
And he just fired the rest of the other 11. It was blah, 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 and he just went out there and all these nice explosions. It was,
uh-huh,
an incredible weapon. I never saw it after that.
What did you carry out there while you were doing guard duty?
M16.
M16.
Right.
Did you have a favorite weapon?
I just took whatever they gave me.
Okay.
Which was M16.
And I
would go to the arms room and they'd give me whatever they happened to have there. The one thing I did do is I had a diet canvas bag, and I would carry as many rounds as I could in it because I didn't want to be out of the perimeter dead with an empty weapon.
Right.
I carried 500 rounds of ammunition.
Okay.
In a duffel bag.
Okay.
Just in case I got thrown out of the perimeter.
Right.
And had to shoot back at somebody. I wanted to make sure I had some good rounds with me. There were a lot of rounds with me.
Uh-huh.
I did go to the range quite often and try to shoot just to keep practice.
You did or did not?
I did.
Okay. And so I asked you about drug use, and you said you were out on the perimeter.
We were out in the Jeep. It was myself and two other NCOs driving around the perimeter one,
uh-huh,
afternoon.
Uh-huh.
And there was an old French bunker there, and we happened to see somebody in it.
Right.
I was on the machine gun. I was on the M60 machine gun on a pod on the back of the Jeep.
Uh-huh.
And the sergeant said, come out in Vietnamese and in English.
Mm-hmm.
And nobody came out. He said, go ahead, charge your weapon. So I charged the weapon, and whoever was in there heard me charge the weapon,
mm-hmm,
and he came out. It was an E-4 Army guy who snuck away from his unit with smoking pot.
Really?
Yeah, so we took him back and turned him into the security police.
Do you know what happened to him?
I have no idea.
Okay.
I thought it was no big deal myself.
Did you see a lot of drug use or not?
That's the only time I remember actually seeing anybody, mm-hmm, smoking marijuana.
Okay.
And I just don't remember any of it in my unit. It could have been going all the time. I don't know. I don't remember seeing any of it. I saw no heroin use. I saw nothing but the alcohol.
Okay.
Which was legal.
Right.
I really saw no illegal drugs, illicit drugs, except the one guy that we caught smoking marijuana in the French bunker.
Right.
I don't know what happened to that guy. Maybe nothing. I don't know.
Yeah. What else did you guys do for entertainment?
I mostly went around taking pictures of everything I could on the base.
Mm-hmm.
day, night, didn't matter to me. I was up photographing everything.
Did you really enjoy photography before you went to Vietnam?
Yes, I did.
Okay.
And while I was in Vietnam, I went to Hong Kong, my R&R.
Okay.
And I bought 7 cameras that people gave me money for to buy. And there, during the 70s in Hong Kong, you could buy a camera for half what you could buy it for in the States.
Uh-huh.
I bought myself 2 cameras and some lenses. And I bought like 6 or 7 cameras for other people that they gave me money to buy and tell me what they wanted.
Right.
It was incredible, the opportunity to buy photo equipment. Even in the exchange, you could get camera equipment pretty cheaply.
So you took a lot of pictures.
A lot of pictures, yes.
And I guess, were you able to develop them there?
As a matter of fact, I was the manager of the photo hobby shop at Food Cat.
Okay.
That was another part-time job I had. I was being a cook, and I was also a Mars operator. But I developed film for people, and developed film for myself, and printed stuff myself, too, at the lab. I did color slides, ektachrome slides.
Mm-hmm.
We had that availability there, and I did black and white prints and negatives.
Okay. It's interesting. You had a lot of free time.
A lot of free time. Like I said, our plane was pretty much working all the time. It didn't break down very much.
Right.
They did break down. I went out there and fixed them.
Uh-huh.
But normally we didn't have to do anything to them because they came back working,
uh-huh.
unlike the F-106, which came back broken every time.
Right, right.
It was like a 10-month vacation to me, other than we would get attacked.
It was like a 10-month vacation?
Other than we were getting attacked, yes.
Okay. Tell me about those attacks. What happened?
Mostly we were getting, 1 week after we got to Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
we had no planes to do work on, so we had a lot of free time then.
Mm-hmm.
We were sleeping until, 9 or 10 in the morning, our whole unit.
Okay.
And about 8:30 in the morning, there was this horrendous boom, and shrapnel all through our barracks. Our barracks had sandbags up to about 4 feet
mm-hmm.
on the outside of the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
Then from there on, there was nothing but the tin roof of the Quonset hut.
Mm-hmm.
And we had wooden shutters that folded down over the windows when we had sandstorms.
Okay.
Keep the sand out. And they'd be folded up at 90 degrees at a flat angle
uh-huh.
of the windows. Well, a friend of mine was across from me, was sleeping with his face up at about 8:30 in the morning. I was sleeping too, and we heard this big boom, and a piece of shrapnel came through the building. It went directly through his shutter and sprayed him with sawdust, basically, on his face.
Mm-hmm.
He got a cut over his eye.
Okay.
He got a purple heart from that.
Okay. Okay. And this is a VC rocket attack?
Right. It was about a 120-millimeter rocket, I believe.
And just one round was fired?
I don't remember. I think there was just one round fired that day.
Okay. Was this a common experience?
But not that common. We did have one that hit. Maybe they fired several rockets. They may have had multiple launcher tubes up there on some hill somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not really sure. But we did get a rocket hit at the entrance of the officers' club, and I just can't remember if it was the same day or not.
Mm-hmm.
It's in my diary. I just don't remember now.
Mm-hmm.
But I think they hit us with multiple rockets that day.
Okay.
I know they did at Phuket one day.
But you had a rocket attack at Phuket?
Right, and I was actually sitting in an aircraft with a Phantom fighter mechanic tech.
Uh-huh.
We did the same on the Phantoms I did on. I worked on the Phantoms just out of sheer boredom because
uh-huh.
our planes were working all the time
uh-huh.
just to find out what their system was like. And he said, I'll learn something about your system. Also, our equipment was pretty large,
uh-huh.
but he helped to carry it in to the unit to our building to get it repaired. So I used Phantom techs to come out and help me on my gunship, and we were sitting in the aircraft about 6:30 one morning, and inside the cockpit of the 119, if you're looking at the fire control system, you're facing backwards, you're facing back away from the windshield.
Mm-hmm.
You're still in the cockpit, but you're facing backwards.
Okay.
And we're sitting there side by side looking at the infrared television system. I'm showing how it works. I can scan around the flight line and everything. And we're sitting facing backwards, and we had headsets on because we have a big ground power unit that's running real loudly outside, so you have to have headsets on to be able to hear each other.
Mm-hmm.
And we heard this big, I thought, what was that? And we spun around and looked out the nose of the aircraft, saw this big fireball out of front of the aircraft. I went, oh, my God, we're being attacked. And he threw his headset off. I tried to unplug mine, so I was a little slower than he was.
Uh-huh.
He went down, and now he's out of the aircraft. in like a snap. I unplugged mine and wore my headsets out and jumped out of the aircraft. Mm-hmm. And found out that morning they hit us with like 7 rockets.
Wow.
And so they used multiple launcher someplace. Mm-hmm. They hit probably 100 yards out in front of our aircraft.
Wow.
And, which was too close for me.
Right, right.
It was actually in line with my aircraft. If it did no door, just a little bit, it would hit right where aircraft was. Uh-huh. Aircraft were in revetments. They had about, I guess, 12 or 15 foot walls, 3 feet thick with dirt in them. Mm-hmm. Keep one plane from blowing up and then blowing up the next plane to it so the blast wouldn't go through the revetment wall.
Right.
So we were pretty well protected unless the thing actually hit us. And the fans were in a thing called Wonder Huts. They were concrete huts they backed the Phantoms into. So if you had one rocket hit in front of one Phantom, it might blow up that Phantom. Actually, if it hit the roof, it wouldn't go through the roof of the Wonder Hut.
Okay. Did they send out teams after these? After the rocket attack was over? Did they send out teams to kind of find these people?
We were stationed there with the... I think it was the White Horse Division, Koreans. I'm not really sure now.
Mm-hmm.
Which it's in my book. Which unit it was that were there. The Koreans probably went out to look for them. I really don't know.
What do you think of? I'm sorry. Go ahead.
But I think of what?
What do you think of the Koreans?
They were excellently trained people. We had a Korean who lived probably about 800 yards away from me.
Uh-huh.
He lived in a bunker underground.
Wow.
And this guy approached me one day when I was, I don't know who he was, he approached me one day when I was about the BX and asked me if I'd buy him a radio from the BX. So I went to the BX. He gave me money.
Mm-hmm.
I went to the BX, bought him a radio, gave it to him. He said, well, come on back, I'll show you where I live. So I went back to his bunker underground.
Uh-huh.
And he was showing me how he lived. He lived in a thing with slits in it to be able to shoot, the firing ports in it to be able to fire out. The enemy. They lived a real rugged life in Vietnam.
Okay.
And while I was talking to him, a master sergeant came in.
Mm-hmm.
He said, oh, Sergeant Pizza. He came to attention and saluted the guy. He said, I want to present to you my master. He said, master sergeant. He said, my master. And by the way, he treated the guy. I think it was his master, actually.
Okay.
It was really, really a different experience.
Yeah.
Compared to the Australians and the Americans, the way both the Vietnamese and the Koreans were treated by their superiors and the way they treated subordinates, too.
Right.
We actually had a Korean wounded at a 105 howitzer position in Phan Rang,
uh-huh.
and they hauled him to the hospital. He got hit in the arm by a piece of shrapnel, and his sergeant was beating him for being stupid and getting wounded.
Wow.
On the way to the hospital.
Wow.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed by that.
That's pretty tough.
I'm glad this is not my army out there. Okay. Good grief.
What do you think of the Australian troops?
They were great. And they had a lot better gear than we had, too. I know they sent a patrol out at Phan Rang to do some reconnoitering. And they were coming back. They walked through our perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Any time, day or night, if you thought there was a suspected enemy coming through the perimeter, you could fire a 40-millimeter grenade, high explosive grenade out. And people did it all the time from the towers that were around the base.
Mm-hmm.
This Australian stepped on one of those grenades that didn't go off when it hit the ground.
Right.
And by him stepping on it, he set it off with his foot. It took off two toes. Two toes, not his whole foot up to his ankle.
Wow.
He'd been wearing our boots. He would have been taking his leg off, at least up to the ankle, maybe up to the knee, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It took off two toes because he was wearing Australian boots with steel shanks down the shaft, the insole of the boot. So I took off two toes instead of his whole foot.
Wow. So
these
guys
were impressed with their material compared to ours.
Uh-huh.
Now, they had Canberra bombers on our base, which is the equivalent of American B-57.
Uh-huh.
It held 4 750-pound bombs in a center line inside the aircraft. I went out and looked at those one day with an Australian, and they could carry 2 750-pound bombs, I think, on each wing. I know they had them at the wing tips. They may have carried them inboard the wings as well. So they could carry at least 6 750-pound bombs on board that aircraft. The bombardier was also the navigator.
Mm-hmm.
He sat behind the pilot when they were flying.
Mm-hmm.
They were going to go on a bomber mission, bombing, actually going to, into the bombing site, he would go walk around the pilot, lay on his stomach in front of the pilot,
uh-huh.
and he looked at the glass bubble he looked out of, and he also had his bombing sites equipment right there to do the bombing. I thought it was really interesting that the bombardier actually got up and walked around the pilot.
Uh-huh.
The navigator then became the bombardier and laid down in front of the pilot to drop the bombs. It was just a different, completely different way of working things.
Definitely.
The Australians were just incredibly great people.
Yeah.
I really enjoyed working with them and being on base with them.
Uh-huh.
And I said we were with the Koreans. I think it was the White Horse Division or the Tiger Division at Phuket that we were with.
Uh-huh.
And I only had one experience with the one Korean sergeant and his master sergeant.
Right.
Which was a good experience.
What did you think of the Arvin?
I thought they were probably good, too. They just didn't care about fighting the war.
Why not, do you think?
I don't think they believed in what they were doing. I think they did it because they were told to do it. And I'm sure that, they, like my German landlord, they were just, you know, snatched from their villages and said, you're going to be in the Army now, folks.
Uh-huh.
They didn't have any real desire to fight against the Viet Cong or the NVA.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not even sure, when we were there, who was NVA and who was Viet Cong and who was who on our base. You had no idea. I know at Thompson Newt, while we were there, the head barber turned out he was Viet Cong, and he went running to the hospital with a couple other guys one day with machine guns, machine gunning patients.
Huh. Did you ever see any of the enemy?
Not to my knowledge.
Okay.
But I got turned on the perimeter. We were expecting wave attacks one night, and they woke me up and put me on the perimeter about 8 o'clock at night. One night, that just phone rang,
mm-hmm.
and with my little duffel bag of 500 rounds and my M16, I think I probably got 4 clips, 20 round magazines instead of 40 round magazines like the NVA had in their AK-47s.
Right.
And those things were gone instantaneously. You pull the trigger, and they were gone. All 20 rounds were gone.
Uh-huh.
You gotta reload. So I had 3 magazines that I kept loaded, and I had one in the M16, and I had 2 taped reversed. So I could pull that one out and reverse the other two and stick one at a time and have those in.
Mm-hmm.
And I had loose magazines also in my bag.
Mm-hmm.
But we got thrown out the perimeter one night, and they took us out in a school bus, dropped us off at the perimeter.
Uh-huh.
We sat out there for about half an hour. I said, okay, I guess nothing's going to happen. So they took us back in, put us back, took us back, took our weapons away from us. They took our weapons away from us and restored them.
Uh-huh.
And in the arms room, and then went back to bed. About 2 hours later, when we back up, went back out on the school bus, got my gun, everything, went back to the perimeter,
mm-hmm.
and set up. Nothing happened again, so they took us back to the barracks, went back, turned our weapons back in, went back to bed. The third time, they woke me up. I staggered out of the room, and we had 55-gallon drums that were cut in half to use as barbecue pits.
Uh-huh.
And I ran into one with my shins.
Uh-huh.
As I was going outside the barracks, and it hurt so bad I saw stars. Actually, saw stars. It hurt so bad. I thought, screw this. If we get wave attack, I don't care anymore. I don't want to go back to bed. Go back to bed. Nothing ever happened.
Okay.
It was incredible. And nobody came and got me. It was really, really weird, I thought.
So I'd say,
where's Pizzo? He should be out here with us.
You just blew off the
attack. And
the
never
deal.
There was one.
And no one said, okay.
No one said anything. It was really unusual, I thought.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in the Army, if one of my troops was missing from a detail, I'd go look for him.
Right.
Or send my NCO or somebody to go look for him.
Right.
It was really weird. Really weird. Nobody even noticed I was gone. Anyway, on the bus, we're going out to fly out to the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing happened.
What did you think of the leadership in Vietnam, beginning with your immediate superiors and then overall?
I didn't even know I had an officer in charge of me any time in Vietnam unless I screwed up somehow.
Okay.
And then I'm not sure, I don't recall who it was in charge of me. I just knew the NCOs were in charge of me.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember any leadership or lack of leadership. We all still kind of did our jobs,
mm-hmm.
and nobody told anybody anything I can remember. I will say that Westmoreland was there in Vietnam at the same time I was. And I thought we had good leadership at that time.
Okay.
And when I went through officer candidate school in the Army, Westmoreland's driver was a black guy. He said, I want to go to Officer Candidate School. And Westmoreland said, no problem. I said, go to Officer Candidate School.
Mm-hmm.
He graduated, so Westmoreland came to Officer Candidate School and commissioned us.
Okay.
Commissioned by a four-star general.
Huh.
So that was pretty neat.
Yeah, yeah.
And I happened to see Westmoreland in 1984 or 85 at the dedication of the Statue of the Vietnam Vets War Memorial when I was stationed in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And he came to the dedication. He looked haggard and old.
Mm-hmm.
It was really bad seeing him looking like that,
mm-hmm.
compared to the way he looked when he commissioned me back in 73.
Right.
I felt really bad for him. He was just hounded by the press and
uh-huh.
everybody else for his conduct in the Vietnam War.
Right.
Although we weren't allowed to do anything.
What do you mean by that?
You had to call the local village chief if you wanted to fire cannons in you know, the proximity of the village. If you wanted to drop bombs from the airplanes, you had to call a local village chief and say, you know, I'm going to drop some bombs here. Is that okay? You have any people out in the rice fields or anything?
Mm-hmm.
They get them in. So we couldn't conduct a war. I had talked to people who actually would take hills and lose five or six guys taking a hill. The next day they'd move off the hill, and 3 days later they'd retake the hill.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd move off, they'd lose some guys, and then they'd retake the hill again and then move off of it again.
Right.
It's worthless. My German landlord in 65 said, if it was a German army over there, what we'd do is we'd take a whole area, we'd move everybody out of the area. Anybody that's left is the enemy, and you could just kill them.
Right.
We didn't do that. We just, you know, we kind of wandered in the area, took over a spot for a while, and then we left it. And then we'd take it over again and leave it.
Mm-hmm.
The conduct of the war was just despicable as far as I'm concerned.
Did you have a lot of conversations with the infantry or people in the field while you were there?
Only on a couple of occasions, and they weren't very happy about what they were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it turns out that the guy I knew that I've known since third grade, was my best friend,
mm-hmm.
ended up in Vietnam in the Army. He got drafted, and he ended up in Vietnam on the border of North and South Vietnam, a place called Dong Ha West.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd call him periodically. I was in Vietnam and talked to him on the phone. And so I was talking to him one day. He said, oh, we're getting a rocket attack. And a rocket hit the top of his bunker and knocked all the lights out. He said, I gotta go. I can't see anything.
Gosh.
Talk to you later. So he was horribly affected by the war. And he said, I'll come down to Da Nang. And you fly up to Da Nang. We'll spend a weekend together.
Mm-hmm.
We did that. It was a really great scene. I actually have a photograph of us. I think I set the camera on the tail of an airplane, put the timer on, and
uh-huh.
we would put our arms around each other.
Uh-huh.
And we're standing there, you know, smiling.
Uh-huh.
I have a self-portrait of us in Vietnam. It was really weird to have him be in Vietnam at the same time I was there.
Right.
He was horribly affected by the war.
Uh-huh.
He still has worse, and I still has nightmares. And we've corresponded for, you know, all the time after Vietnam, although he doesn't want to talk to me anymore.
He doesn't want to talk to you anymore?
No. And I called and talked to him one time. His wife said, I can't get him in the house. He was a new wife.
Uh-huh.
He went to Hawaii on his R&R. When he got to Hawaii, well, I grew up with him and his wife. They went to high school and grade school and everything together.
Uh-huh.
When they got married, they were just perfect. They raced cars together. He had a Chevy 2 that had a 396 engine in it, 4-speed. Mm-hmm. He'd take out to the drag strip and race all the time. They did everything together. Went deer hunting together. Did absolutely everything together.
Mm-hmm.
He was in Vietnam. She was having an affair. When he got to Hawaii on his R&R, she told him she wanted a divorce.
Oh, man.
So he was crushed by that.
Right.
And his life was totally different after that.
What do you think he doesn't want to talk to you now because of?
I just don't have any idea. We stayed with him several times when I was at his first and second wedding,
mm-hmm.
and this was his second wedding, and I knew both his wives for a long time,
mm-hmm.
and I've known him forever too. And he doesn't want to talk to me anymore. His wife said, I can't get him to come in and talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Last time I tried to call, so I sent him Christmas cards and letters all the time. I quit, totally quit, because I figured he doesn't want to talk to me again. So.
You think it's Vietnam related?
I don't know, but I know he still has nightmares, and he'll get up and swing at the dresser doors or whatever.
Hmm.
He'll have PTSD, I'm sure.
Right. Have you had anything like that after your time?
No, nothing at all. Although, when I was at Dover,
uh-huh.
our noon siren on top of our hangar that would go off at noon. And there was a guy who just came back from Vietnam, a tech sergeant. He was walking toward us, and we were going to chow. We were walking toward him, and the siren went off. He hit the ground. We said, "Whoa, he must have just come back from Vietnam." That was hilarious. I want to say, when I came back from Vietnam, every time I hear a thump, I was on the ground for probably a year or so. Anytime I heard a siren, I was on the ground, too.
Interesting.
So it's just like Pavlov's dog training.
Right. Except it's not food you're getting.
You're not getting food. You're getting not shot is what you're getting.
Right. What kind of access did you have to churches and religion?
We had a church
like
there, and I went to I guess you'd call it Christmas Mass.
Mm-hmm.
I was Mary's Methodist, but I did live at the Catholic Military Academy for a whole semester.
Mm-hmm.
I went to church 5 times a day, but I'm not extremely religious, but I did go to Christian Catholic Mass on Christmas Eve,
mm-hmm.
just because I thought it was a good thing to do. So we had churches available, we had pastors available.
Okay.
I didn't go to church, as I can recall, at any other time in Vietnam. I do have a picture of the church during Christmas, it's all decorated up.
Okay.
It's really weird. Our whole base was just so lit up. It was like, here we are, enemy floodlights everywhere.
You mean in general every night lit up?
Every night lit up, yes.
Huh.
During Christmas, it was really lit up.
Uh-huh.
Now, I used to go to the movies all the time, and
uh-huh.
I got to see the movie MASH, all from Vietnam,
okay.
which was about Vietnam, basically.
Yeah.
It was really strange to see the movie while I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
And you just never knew. It was really strange. You never knew who was going to blow you away. A Vietnamese that could be working with you,
uh-huh.
15 hours a day could turn out to be Viet Cong.
Uh-huh.
Man or woman or child, you just didn't know.
Did you have those thoughts daily?
Oh, sure. I always wondered if our two Hoochmans were, VC or something. But they can't possibly be because they're too nice. They could have been. Who knows? I don't know. I do worry about what happened to them after the war was over.
Uh-huh.
If they had worked for us, both the lady who was at Two Cats
mm-hmm.
and the two girls who worked for us at the base in Phan Rang, I wonder if they were, taken off some prisoner of war camp for working for Americans. I just don't have a clue. I really worry about what happened to those poor people, all three of them.
What was the bravest action that you witnessed in Vietnam while you were there?
That's not a good question. I don't remember anything about any kind of brave action at all.
Okay.
I just don't recall anything about any kind of brave action that happened.
Do you have a...
This is like living in the States, except we get rocketed and mortared occasionally.
Uh-huh. Do you have a really memorable experience that will always stay with you?
I was walking back, as I said, I was the manager of the photo hobby shop at Phu Cat
mm-hmm.
for a while, and one night I closed the hobby shop down, and I was walking, this is really not memorable at all, but I was walking back to the barracks,
mm-hmm.
there's a 155, not 105, a 155 howitzer someplace close by, and it went off, and I thought I was dead. If they just fired the cannon, and I was fairly close to where they fired it from, I saw a flash, and I thought somebody blew me up. That was about the most memorable experience I had there.
Okay.
And I hit the ground, and I thought, somebody blew me up. They just dropped a bomb or a rocket on me.
Uh-huh.
It was just a cannon firing. Huh. I was just in close proximity to it. That's the only thing.
Mm-hmm.
But although we did have a thing called an arc light. Do you know what arc light is?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we had an arc light probably 20 miles from our location.
Okay.
And I was on the top bunk on the second floor of this barracks that had sandbags. On the first floor.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think any sandbags anywhere up on the second floor at all. So I was not protected at all if we got any rockets or anything near the barracks.
Mm-hmm.
But this arc light happened, and I was sleeping at like 7:30 in the morning. It actually shook me out of bed.
You fell off the bunk?
I fell off the bunk, yes. It actually rattled me off the bed.
Wow.
I thought, what is going on? What is that? I didn't know what it was.
Mm-hmm.
I thought we were being attacked or something. I had no idea what was going on. That was kind of a memorable experience.
Who told you it was like B-52 bombing?
I don't recall. Somebody explained to me what happened. I thought, what is that? What's going on? They said it's a B-52 arc light going over.
Huh.
I don't know where they were dropping their bombs. at Phuket. I don't know if it was close around there. Mm-hmm. But I did, we had to go pick up a lieutenant one day.
Uh-huh.
We couldn't really go off base very much. At Fanrang, I went to the beach like once or twice.
Uh-huh.
We had an armored car in front of our big tractor trailer hauled plywood covered tractor trailer.
Mm-hmm.
We had an armored car in front of us and an armored car behind us, but we were in plywood, big plywood box, basically,
mm-hmm.
while I was going to the beach. I thought, well, you know, if we run into Viet Cong, we're in trouble because this plywood isn't doing anything for us.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was splinters when the bullets come through it, and we're going to get shot besides.
Right.
The guys in the armored car are probably okay. But we got to the beach, and I thought it was really beautiful, the beach, just
mm-hmm.
incredible. There was an older NCO next to me at the beach. He had a Vietnamese girlfriend and her little Vietnamese daughter.
Mm-hmm.
He took the Vietnamese daughter and was playing with her in the water, so I was speaking to the Vietnamese woman
uh-huh.
in Vietnamese, and she offered me what looked like an enchilada.
Uh-huh.
I thought, well, what does this have in it? She told me what it was in Vietnamese, which was donkey or jackass.
Really?
And I thought, you know, I haven't had my gabaglobulin shot yet. I'm going to test the waters here and tasting it, but thanks for actually offering it to me. I talked to her for a while, and it was really interesting talking to her.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote a letter to my wife back when I got back to the barracks.
Uh-huh.
I said, went to the beach today, and a woman offered me a piece of ass at the beach.
So
she did show me a piece of jackass in this thing. I thought it was kind of funny. I don't know. It was really memorable going to the beach and seeing Vietnamese women coming down to the beach to meet with the guys. And there were also some young women that came down with single guys at the beach, too. They were probably about, I don't know, 20, 25 years old, the women that I saw there.
Were they just like your escorts for the day? Or?
I don't know. I don't know. They're not my escorts.
Right.
Nobody
right.
was there with me. I don't think these women had made plans to go with them or not. I did actually, when I was at Fanrang,
mm-hmm.
a Vietnamese woman said that I was Dep Lum. And I thought, that's
uh-huh.
what that's. And so I was Dep, that means I'm very handsome. I'm very
uh-huh.
pretty. I
very
guess
handsome.
She said. So she said, would you like to go to the beach? I said, sure, I'd like to go. And so we made kind of a date to go to the beach.
Uh-huh.
And I couldn't go at that time, so I don't know if she went to the beach or not. But I never saw her again, and I remember.
Okay.
I don't know sure who she was. I don't know if she was one of our maids or what.
Right.
I don't know.
Did you ever have any exposure to Agent Orange or see any of this to full
time? I used to see the ranch hands, which we call C-123s that drop the Agent Orange. I used to see them flying over all the time.
Uh-huh.
I don't recall ever seeing it being sprayed anywhere.
Uh-huh.
When I came back to the States, I was an assistant manager of a Red Cross in Colorado Springs. It's a Red Cross shelter.
Mm-hmm.
This was in 85 or 86, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure, 87. And one of the guys that was there was a black guy who had all these basically beige spots all over his body. And he said he used to load Agent Orange into the aircraft.
Wow.
And we have a friend here in town who's a realtor. Her husband flew the C-123 mm-hmm. ranch hands with Agent Orange dropping it, and he died of some horrible cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And those watching people know, I know that have died from Agent Orange.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure the black guy died from Agent Orange
mm-hmm.
at some point in time now. The only people that I knew of that died from it. I do know that somebody I talked to, a Marine, said they were out in the bush one day, and this plane came over and dropped, sprayed them with something, and I guess it was Agent Orange.
Huh.
I also have a Marine friend who here in town who's ex-Marine.
Mm-hmm.
He had to go through psychiatric counseling for 2 or 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
He weighs about 90 pounds. He's a real small guy.
Mm-hmm.
He's a butcher at Safeway.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was so small, he was the same size as the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
He was sent into the tunnels. You know, they found tunnels.
Okay.
He had a horrible experience in Vietnam. He never saw a base the whole 13 months he was there.
Wow.
He was there for 13 months in the bush, living in a tent or whatever,
mm-hmm.
the whole time. So he had a incredibly horrible experience compared to me in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
I went to Da Nang to get some parts. We had aircraft stations in Da Nang, too.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw, our troops lived in two-story air-conditioned barracks in Da Nang,
mm-hmm.
in my squadron, the 18th Special Operations Squadron. I had to walk by some Marines. They had tents, and they had tubes going into the ground to urinate into.
Mm-hmm.
We had air-conditioned barracks. They were probably 50 yards away from that. Maybe 20 yards away from that. And showers. I mean, I had a shower that was outside of my barracks. It was a complete closed bathroom. It probably had 8 toilets in it and probably 2 to 4 showers that had could accommodate maybe 10 people, 8 or 10 people.
Mm-hmm.
We had facilities to be clean every day, unlike the Marines and the Army, too.
Hmm.
Which their experience was tremendously different from mine, I'm sure.
Do you have trouble relating to those veterans or vice versa?
Yes, I do. I went to a Vietnam Vets Outreach Unit in Colorado Springs because I thought I had some problems with Vietnam, and I was in a group of about 20 guys, and they were all ex-Marines, Navy, medics, and Army. And every one of them was an alcoholic. They were a drug addict or had had 7 or 10 marriages. I'm exaggerating about that, but they had numerous marriages. And they were just in, you know, just horrible condition.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't hold a job. I thought, this is not for me. I don't have this kind of experience in Vietnam. I have a good experience in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
So I was only there once or twice, and I left that thing. I thought, I don't need to be in this thing.
Right. When you were,
I think most people had horrible experience in Vietnam, I believe.
I think it varies basically as to where you were stationed.
Right.
In country.
And now, there's a tech sergeant that I went to Vietnam with.
Mm-hmm.
That I was stationed at Phan Rang with. That my wife and I went with her girlfriend, who's a lawyer now, who was living in Denver and was dating this blind judge, who's a child court judge in Denver.
Mm-hmm.
Because he couldn't see, had a limo that he bought.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, we're going to go up to Black Hawk for dinner, and we're going to go with the blind judge up to Black Hawk. You want to go? So Jan and I said, yes, let's go. So wife and I and the blind judge and her girlfriend go up to Black Hawk in this limo. I thought, that driver looks so familiar to me.
Mm-hmm.
So after we ate, I went out and talked to him. It was a guy I was in Vietnam with.
Really?
The tech sergeant. So I have an actual photograph of him in Vietnam.
Wow.
We were drinking beer one day in Vietnam.
Wow.
He said he went back to Vietnam once again.
Mm-hmm.
He said it's such a good experience that he volunteered to go back because we got, you know, you weren't taxed on your pay.
Mm-hmm.
It was little pay at all. Any pay at all was horrible at that time period. But you get taxed on it, and you get a combat pay, too.
Mm-hmm.
So it was good duty for us.
Right.
He enjoyed it the first time and the second time.
Huh.
I'm not sure where he was the second time. And we had aircraft, also two bases in Thailand.
Uh-huh.
Some of the guys I was with actually lived in Thailand on the economy, had girlfriends in Thailand and everything, so they had a real good experience in Southeast Asia, too.
Right. What access did you have to American news while you were there?
We had TV in our... actually, our squadron repair shop.
Mm-hmm.
We could see the war going on, you know, in black and white.
Right.
24 hours a day.
Right.
It was really such a weird thing to see this war going on, those people dying, and we feel like we were totally safe on our bases, and we're there in Vietnam too.
Mm-hmm.
Like taking an American city and putting it in another country. It was totally sheltered. Well, I felt it was totally sheltered, although we get attacked periodically.
Mm-hmm.
I think I was in 27 rocket or mortar attacks. I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where my... there he is. I can take a look real quick. I have my diary right here.
Okay.
Attempt 12 in Vietnam. Let's see what it says.
While you're looking, let me ask you another question. Did you see or have any experience with wild animals over there?
I don't recall seeing any wild animals at all.
How about snakes?
No, I didn't see. I like snakes, and I've had all kinds of poisonous snakes and rattlesnakes, all kinds of different things, and pet snakes. I had like a 3-foot long king snake.
Mm-hmm.
So snakes don't bother me. I didn't see any there.
Okay.
See, I was in 22. Rocket attacks from 25th of October 69 to 5th August 70.
Okay. And that's when you left in August 1970?
5th August 70, right.
Okay.
Actually, while I was in Vietnam, I applied to go to college.
Okay.
And because I was getting the GI Bill. I thought, well, this would be wonderful. I'd go to college. So I applied for an early out to go to college, and I got an early out. I got a 3-month early out to go back to go to college from Vietnam.
That's
a war zone. I mean, is that weird or what? That they gave me
weird.
Early out to go to college from a war? I was thrilled. I thought, I've been here for 10 months. That's enough for me.
Right. And you went back and immediately enrolled?
Yes, I did. I went. My wife and I moved to Houston, Texas, and I enrolled at the University of Houston, where my cousin was. He had a PhD, and he was in business school there teaching. He said, "Come to U of H; it's a real good school." So I went there for a couple semesters, and my cousin, other cousin who happened to live in Pasadena, said, "If you want a job, go out to the steel mill here, and you can work in the steel mill, the slab yard." So I went out there and I worked in the steel mill for a few months. I heard these guys say, 45 more years, I can retire. 37 more years, I can retire. 26 more years, I can retire. You got to stay in this place, for this hot, sweaty place, for 50 years where you can retire. I'm going back in the military. So I enlisted in the Army.
Right.
Went back in the military.
And how long did you stay in the Army once you re-enlisted?
I stayed from 66 to 70 in the Air Force.
Right.
I went in 71 into the Army. And got run over by a drunk driver while I was on leave in 1976.
Right.
And I got medically retired in 77 or 78.
Okay.
I was in the hospital for 8 months.
Okay.
I figured out the hospital, but I got medically retired, so I was in for a total of 11 years.
Okay.
Both branches.
Okay.
So I'm a retired captain with...
I'm sorry?
I'm a retired captain.
Okay.
Army captain, and I make pretty close to what a brigadier colonel or one-star general does over 20 retirement pay because of the percentage of my disability.
Uh-huh. Okay. Okay. Let's go back to when you left Vietnam. How did you feel when you flew out of there?
Well, while I was in Vietnam, I became an anti-war protester, basically.
Oh, really? Okay.
Oh, yeah. I just thought, we shouldn't be here. We're doing bad things here.
Uh-huh. What did you do? What kind of activities did you participate in?
I didn't participate in anything. I just saw our planes dropping bombs and doing bad things that just not called for. When we were over in Cambodia and Laos, we did this incursion back in 1970.
Uh-huh.
Well, we were losing like 500 guys a day in Cambodia and Laos.
Uh-huh.
I was based at Phu Cat with my 3 gunships out of this Phantom fighter wing that had 40 Phantom fighters.
Uh-huh.
I got to the flight line one day with the Phantom fighter technician that worked on the same thing I did. He was the guy I was in the plane with when we got the rocket attack.
Uh-huh.
I said, golly. All 5 planes, probably 35 planes, or whatever, 30 of them, they're all loaded up with these bombs. They're 750-pound bombs. And I said, "This, you go over Cambodia Lens, right?" He said, no, those are blue bombs. Those are dummy bombs. They're flying over the South China Sea, dropping them into the ocean, practicing dropping bombs.
Huh.
I thought, wait a minute now. We drop bombs. These guys drop bombs every day on enemy targets.
Uh-huh.
We're losing 500 guys a day over Cambodia or Laos. Why do they need practice dropping dummy bombs into the ocean?
Right.
We're losing all these guys in Vietnam and in Cambodia, Laos, and Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
That just didn't make any sense to me, except that, oh, we're not really here to win a war. We're here to make money for civilian industry.
Is that?
I got it.
Is that what you came to the conclusion of?
That's what I came to the conclusion of, that our war was only to be there to make money for civilian industry in the United States, not to win anything.
Huh. And that was while you were there in Vietnam?
That was while I was there.
I figured that out.
That's right.
Actually made me ill.
Uh-huh. I see our gunships go up, and I knew they were protecting people, and I was hoping they were saving lives on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
But when I saw all of the available flyable planes in our Phantom wing take off with dummy bombs, we're losing all these guys in Cambodia and Laos, I thought, there's something wrong with this war.
Mm-hmm.
There's something wrong when you can't put these planes with real bombs to go over and drop them on the enemy. What does that make any sense to you at all?
Only that they were trying to practice, which, you know, you
which
would,
they did every day.
Yeah, you would think at that point.
On real targets.
Yeah, yeah. So what other activities or events happened that continue to reinforce that, your feeling? Or did anything else happen?
I can't think of anything specific that happened. I know we just, you know what hookers are called, hookers, right? Because of General Hooker, they had these prostitutes for his men during the Civil War, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, we had massage parlors on both bases I was stationed at.
Uh-huh.
massage in a 99-degree temperature weather with some woman rubbing you down with oil or whatever in 99 degrees, mm-hmm. it's not a massage parlor, it's a whorehouse.
Right.
We had whorehouses on both bases. I never bothered going into one of them. Sometimes I wish I had, but I never did.
Uh-huh.
But I was in, at the work at the mortuary. We had a guy that came back from Vietnam who had not a mark on his body. He died from some horrible venereal disease that they could not cure.
Uh-huh.
And it wasn't AIDS, because he looked good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what it was, but I thought, I'm not having sex with anybody in Vietnam after seeing this guy.
Uh-huh. So these quote-unquote massage parlors, that just further gave you distaste for what we were doing there?
Yes.
Okay.
So I thought, we're hiring their young women for prostitutes.
Uh-huh.
And that's not what they want to do. But they need to make money for their families.
Right.
But these other women that chose to do it a different way by working in our barracks, you know, shining shoes and making beds and stuff.
Right.
I thought, what a horrible, you know, way for us to treat these people. And I could not understand why we were there doing this stuff. We would take over, like say, a hill or something, and then leave it.
Right.
We'd bomb something and then leave it or rebuild it.
Did any of the other men you served with share these feelings?
Most of them, I believe, felt pretty much the same way I did, that we had no reason to be there,
uh-huh.
no right to be there.
Uh-huh.
I think most of the younger guys, the senior NCOs, probably didn't feel that way. They probably felt like they were there for God and country. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. How long into your tour there did you start having these feelings?
I was in about 3 months.
Okay.
Of being there.
And so you applied for college basically while there.
I never got there.
Was that part of your plan? I mean, was that part of, you know?
I thought I wanted to go to college when I got out. I didn't think I'd get early out. I figured there's no way I'm going to get early out from here. But if I do, that'd be wonderfully less chance of me getting killed over
right,
here.
Right.
Although, like I said, I don't remember seeing it, but maybe 6 or 8 Air Force guys come through our mortuary.
Uh-huh.
And those were mostly like pilots. I don't remember.
How did you feel when you left Vietnam?
I felt sad. That and I felt glad that I made it through the war and didn't
uh-huh.
die.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, you know, I have to find another country to go to die in, I guess. I don't know. But I was getting out, so I guess I really didn't worry about that happening.
Uh-huh. Why did you feel sad?
I just thought the whole reason we were there was wrong, and we were losing a lot of people for no reason at all. Why send all these young people and old people mm-hmm. to war to die
mm-hmm.
for industry? You know, to have a good economy.
Mm-hmm.
And all the war is not the best way to get an economy going. That's what we were doing, basically.
So your thoughts, you said initially when you were flying over, was, you know, the stop communist aggression and
right.
help South Vietnam stay
right.
independent. And,
right.
And that stuff had gone out the window?
Very important.
That stuff had gone out the window? That it, you would,
yes.
Okay.
I thought we're just here to make money for civilian industry, and that's it.
Okay. Do you remain convinced of that today?
No. I'm not sure it's civilian industry. It's just, I don't know why we're in Vietnam. It just doesn't make any sense at all. When my wife and I went to London recently,
mm-hmm.
actually last November, and we took a 3-hour cab tour of London,
mm-hmm.
and the guy said, I'm going to take you by a place here. This guy worked as a, not a waiter, but a dishwasher at this restaurant
mm-hmm.
in downtown London.
Mm-hmm.
He's responsible for the death of about 10 million people. Do you know who he is? I said, I don't have a clue who it is. He's a college student working as a dishwasher in a real nice fancy restaurant in London, and I can't remember, it was like 1917, 25, I'm not sure, mm-hmm. 1920, 25, 27, I'm not sure when it was. And I thought, who is it? He took me to the plaque on the wall of this hotel. It was Ho Chi Minh.
Yeah.
That's the guy who we should have gone in with. He was not a communist, he was a nationalist.
Mm-hmm.
We should have gone with him, not South Vietnamese government. It changed every other day.
Mm-hmm.
It was totally in it for the money. It was just incredible. The waste over there was just horrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how can you have a photo hobby shop and all his craft shops and everything in a war zone. And actually, I went, while I was in FUCAT, you know what the CLEP tests are? Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, the CLEP test.
Yeah. I took the CLEP test while I was in Vietnam. And I got my first year of college in Vietnam. What kind of deal is that? Who goes to college in a war?
Very unlike America's World War II experience.
I don't think anybody did that in World War II. Unless they were stationed in London, they knew they were going to go to the mainland to die on the Omaha Beach or something.
Did you think that Vietnam would really be that much different? You know, you had these expectations or maybe these images.
I thought it was going to be like World War II. We were actually taking over a piece of land, and we were helping the the populace there to maintain their democracy. They're probably poorer but freer now than they were when we were there. I mean, they're a really poor economy. But we're over there now. IBM is over there. We're having, Nike tissues are probably over there, too. Who knows? It's incredible.
If there's anything you could change about your experience in Vietnam, what would it be?
Just to try to get off the base more. And actually, while I was at Phu Cat, as I said, I walked through the fence with my camera one day. Which was really where I was going to cut off fatigues. Above the knee, and I didn't have a shirt on. I just walked off the base, no gun, nothing, and there were some cattle outside the base, right outside the perimeter. And I went out and talked to these Vietnamese cattle men and women. There were children, ages from like 6 to probably 15, and there were two young guys that were probably about 20, 25 years old that were, Arvin reservists, I guess what you would call them, or National Guard, and they were tending their cows out there. So I took a picture of these two guys that were actually in the military, but off either like National Guardsmen or whatever, or they could have been Viet Cong. I don't have a clue.
Right.
But one of them had a fatigue shirt on, an Arvin fatigue shirt on. So I took pictures of these guys, and I took pictures of all of them, and they took pictures of me with all of them. I thought, how weird that I could walk off the base. If you aren't there, if they're Viet Cong, they're not killing me. So they didn't have the same feeling about me that I would have if I was Vietnamese. We were raping their country, basically, and destroying their country. I mean, can you imagine what that Agent Orange did to all their foliage over there? I'm surprised anything even grows there now. We dropped that stuff everywhere. We just basically destroyed their country for democracy? I don't think so.
When you flew back over to the United States, what was the reception like for you at the airport and then when you
went home? I was in jungle fatigues when I got to the airport.
Where did you fly into?
I flew to SeaTac.
Where?
Seattle, Tacoma.
Okay, Seattle. Okay.
What's it called? Where the Air Force Base is there.
I'm not sure.
I was just up there not too long ago, too. What is that Air Force Base? We're on those Capital Airways things, I think. Like 707. We flew in. We landed. I was in my fatigues. I got off the plane. We were on the base. I went to the barracks, took off my fatigues and my boots and everything, just underwear, hat, everything, and threw it in the trash can. And took a shower, changed, got the red dirt off me. Vietnam was notorious for this red dirt, which takes a couple of months to get it all off of you. And you come back and wash it off, put on civilian clothes, and I pretended like I was a civilian and had always been a civilian and never been in the military.
Okay.
Because I knew people weren't happy about us being over there.
Right.
This is 1970. It's McCord Air Force Base.
Okay.
It's McCord. It's in the. It's in Tacoma.
And did you? You flew home from there?
I flew to San Antonio from there.
Okay.
And where my father was living, and my wife had gone down there to stay with them. So I met up with my family. They were really happy to see me home. saving sound. When I went to the University of Houston, my wife and I moved to Houston, mm-hmm. there were a lot of protest things at U of H. I didn't get into any of them, but I just thought the war was totally wrong from that point on.
Yeah, I still do that. Okay. America was still involved. I wanted to ask what you thought of American policy. After you came home, we were there for three more years.
As a matter of fact, I got commissioned in January of 73, and we didn't leave until 75. So I could have gone back to Vietnam as a lieutenant mm-hmm. in the Army, which I don't think anybody classmates of 200 who graduated from went to Vietnam. I don't think anybody did. Mm-hmm. You're winding down so much mm-hmm. at that point in time.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember how you felt in 1975 in April when Saigon fell?
I thought it was horrible. I thought it was horrible that it fell, although I thought finally getting rid of this corrupt government, mm-hmm. although I'm not sure if the communist, I don't think any government is a good government. I don't care if it's communist, democratic, or whatever, they're all corrupt. But I thought it may be better, the people may be better off. Although I was worried about the people that I knew,
right.
and I wasn't going to happen to them.
Right.
The people that will work for the Americans. As you saw them trying to escape over the walls of the embassy.
Uh-huh.
That was just horrible. And you know, what happened to those poor people? Did the North Vietnamese take revenge out on them? I just don't know. I worry about that. Because they did what they thought they had to do to stay alive.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't work for Americans because of our political system or beliefs in our political system. They worked for us because they needed money to survive.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that you probably could track them down. Or at least their families.
I don't have any idea who they were. I don't remember their first names. They're in my book here, but I don't remember who they were.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know any last names at all.
Hmm. What do you think about your service in Vietnam today?
What do I think about it?
Yeah. When you reflect upon your service.
Like I did the best thing I could do at the time for my country.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I did anything for Vietnam.
Okay.
I think it was bad that we were over there.
Uh-huh.
We just lost fewer people than we lost in Korea, and over a longer period of time, though.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a horrible thing. We had no reason to be there. The French were right to get out when they did. They were there for 100 years, though. It took them longer to figure it out than we did.
Mm-hmm.
We should never have been in the first place. How what?
I was going to ask you, how has it affected your life since you've been back and in the last 30 years or so?
Well, can you stop the thing? This is not for public.
Absolutely. Hold on just a second.
Okay.
Okay, sir, could you talk about, how do you see Vietnam today? What's your perception of the country today?
I think it's probably a good place to be able to go now, although my present wife is disabled.
Uh-huh.
And she uses Canadian canes to get around. I don't think she could get around Vietnam too well.
Uh-huh.
I don't think we'd go there for vacation, but I would really like to go back and see what the country, how it's doing now.
Right. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese living here in the United States?
Yes, I have. We go up to Portland periodically, and we go to Vietnamese restaurants
right,
there.
Right.
I talked to the Vietnamese there. One of them was over here on a scholarship going to college.
Mm-hmm.
She works there. And her family, I guess the family, I'm not sure if it's her family's restaurant or just a Vietnamese restaurant, but she works there as well as goes to college.
Mm-hmm.
I try to practice in Vietnamese that I have left.
Right.
With her.
Okay.
I don't really see many other Vietnamese anywhere. We don't have a lot in Bend.
Right.
Bend is, actually, Oregon's like 98% Caucasian.
Okay.
And Portland's got some blacks, Hispanics, and Chinese, and Vietnamese,
mm-hmm.
but most of Oregon is 98% white.
Okay. Have you ever been to the Vietnam Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C.?
Yes, I went there while I was stationed in Virginia with the agency, and I was actually at the wall for
mm-hmm.
the dedication of the statue
okay.
that Westmoreland was there.
Okay.
Or, and I saw him, he's a general that commissioned me in 73.
Right.
And it was really tragic to see how he's gone downhill since then. He gave a talk up there, and it was just really sad. But the wall, actually, a fellow who lived across the street from me in San Antonio as I was growing up was probably about 5 years older than me. And we weren't really that good of friends, but I felt like he was an older brother type person, even though we weren't that close.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd go over and see what hot rod he was working on, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So he became a helicopter pilot, and I thought, what a wonderful thing to do. I like to fly, so I actually put in, I was in the Air Force working on the F-106s in Dover.
Mm-hmm.
I put in paperwork to transfer, do a branch transfer to go to Warminster Flight School.
Mm-hmm.
I passed the physical, the eye test, everything else. I had all the paperwork in, and he was shot down in Vietnam and killed.
Mm.
I thought, well, I guess I'm not going to do that. So I wrote the paperwork, and I stayed in the Air Force, and then went to Vietnam as a mechanic on the gunship.
Right, right. What were your impressions of the wall itself?
It was incredible. I mean, I've heard some bad things about the design. It was designed by, you know, a Chinese person or something like that. And actually, we have her book, was it Bao?
Designer?
Maya Lin. Yeah, Maya Lin, I think is her name.
Uh-huh.
And I heard some, you know, a slash in the ground, all kinds of bad stuff about it. But the first time I was there, it was incredibly moving
mm-hmm.
for me to see the thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I took a rubbing of my next door neighbor's name and sent it to his parents.
Hmm.
After I did it, I went, oh, God. I did the wrong thing. I should have done that because they're going to feel bad seeing his name.
Mm-hmm.
They were happy to get the rubbing, actually.
Yeah.
And it was funny seeing the statue there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a Hispanic person
mm-hmm.
in the statue and a black person in the statue. And guess who's in front? The white guy.
Mm-hmm.
The white guy's leading
mm-hmm.
or whatever. He's in front. So it's just this real bad symbol. I think that the white folks are in charge, folks. All you other races, you know, go to the back of the line.
Right. Are there any?
I like the statue, and I like the wall, too.
Okay.
And I saw all kinds of flowers, and I took pictures while I was there. And I saw all kinds of letters that were put at the wall.
Uh-huh.
They have a whole monster memorabilia thing there in D.C. from all the stuff they've collected
right.
at the wall.
Right. Are there any songs or musical groups that remind you of your time in Vietnam?
Oh, yeah. I just had the music go through my brain and it just went away. Aretha Franklin? Yeah. And what's the song? It was on China Beach that they played every time China Beach came on. You ever remember that? Have you ever seen
uh-huh.
that series?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, it's the song they played when China Beach came on. It was Aretha Franklin.
This is a specific Aretha Franklin song.
Yeah, specific song, yeah.
Okay.
I can get some clues here. Jan, where are you? What's the Aretha Franklin song that was on?
Is it Reflections?
Reflections, right? Is that it? Yeah, Reflections, that's the one.
Is that it? Okay.
Yeah, Reflections, yeah. That's the one I always think about when I think about Vietnam.
Okay.
And I listen to oldies radio here
uh-huh.
in Bend. And I'll say, oh, there's a Vietnam song.
What musical groups or any other songs?
Well, the Beatles and,
uh-huh.
and God, I just can't remember all the different ones. They're just incredible. Every time I turn on the radio, I hear songs from Vietnam. Oh, yeah, I remember that one.
Mm-hmm.
In the barracks sleeping, heard that on the radio.
Mm-hmm. What about books on Vietnam today? Are there any that you really find worthwhile?
I've got We Were Soldiers Once and Young, but I haven't read that yet.
Okay.
I've got one called Anytime, Anyplace,
mm-hmm.
which is about special operations,
okay.
which is what I was in. I've got the United States Air Force in Southeast Asia, fixed-wing gunships, 1962 to 1972.
Mm-hmm.
And when we left Vietnam, we gave our gunships to the Vietnamese.
Right, right, as part of the Vietnamization policy.
Right.
Did you think that was a viable policy?
Oh, yeah, that was great.
Okay.
They give them everything. They'll bring it back to the States. Although, Halbert Air Force Base, or I think it's Halbert Field, down in Florida, has the gunships now.
Oh, really?
Yeah, although I'm not sure they have any C-119 gunships. I don't know if they're still in existence.
Mm-hmm.
My wife did taxes for H&R Block, and when we were in Colorado Springs, and she did taxes for a guy who started a fledgling business
mm-hmm.
Selling models that were made in the Philippines
mm-hmm.
of different aircraft. And for Christmas, she bought me the model of one of the ghost ships I worked on.
Hmm.
It's actually the little decal on the side of it is one of the actual ghost ships that was at my forward operating location. And actually, what's interesting is when our aircraft came, when the 190s came through across the ocean, they stopped and landed in the Philippines. And some flight line guy mm-hmm. in the Philippines actually put painted pictures on each one of the gunships and gave them names.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Super Sal, which is a giant pig with Gatling guns coming out the side of it.
Mm-hmm.
One of them was Charlie Brown Special. And Lucy's pregnant, and she's saying, "Damn you, Charlie Brown, should we call the Viet Cong? It's Charlie Brown." we had the Polish cannon, which was an elephant, firing a spear out of his snout,
mm-hmm.
out of his trunk. And we just had just all these different... Oh, we had Fly United, which was pretty graphic. It was two... geese flying and they're having sex and they're flying through the air. That's why it's called Fly United.
Right.
We had 18 of them, and guys painted all 18 while they were in the Philippines before they got to Vietnam.
Hmm.
I don't know if I have pictures of all of them, but I have pictures of a lot of them.
Right. Do you find any of the movies that have come out since the war interesting or authentic?
I saw Platoon not too long ago, and that was probably pretty authentic.
Uh-huh.
It's pretty grim.
Yeah. Okay. If you...
I don't like to watch Vietnam War movies.
You don't?
Not particularly.
Okay.
I think they're kind of changed from what it really was.
That the war movies themselves...
Yeah, they're kind of altered.
They're altered.
Probably.
Okay.
Make them more dramatic or
uh-huh.
or less dramatic. I mean, we did such bad things to the Vietnamese people. It's just horrible.
If you walked into a classroom today to talk about Vietnam, what would
I'd like
you,
to do that. That'd be good.
What would you tell the young students about Vietnam, about the Vietnam War?
I'd tell them that we went over there for all the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I thought we were over there to help people, and we really went over there to help our American industry.
Mm-hmm.
And that it was a beautiful country, and the Vietnamese people were good people, but they were in a bad situation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's what the whole thing is, really.
Okay. What do you think the United States learned from the war? What kind of lessons are there for the United States?
I don't know that the government learned any lessons from it, but I know that one thing is you need to be able to give the commanders total power to move their troops
mm-hmm.
and to do what they need to do on the ground. And we didn't do that. We had to call in ahead of time to villages and say, well, we're coming through your area, so make sure you get all your people out of the field. And if they were Viet Cong...
Mm-hmm.
They were putting all the Viet Cong people away,
mm-hmm.
underground, you know, hideouts or something.
Right.
And so it's just, you have to let the commanders command, and we did not do that. We had civilians commanding the war in
mm-hmm.
Vietnam,
mm-hmm.
or running the war, and they did a lousy job. And I'm sure that's what did Westmoreland in, as far as why he looked so bad, because he was not allowed to actually prosecute the war as he saw fit. As none of the commanders were allowed to do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just unfortunate. They had to do what the civilian heads of state wanted us to do back in this country.
Right.
That's no way to run a war, folks.
Right. Is there anything else that you'd like to add or say?
I can't think of anything offhand. Just that I thought it was a beautiful country and I loved the people.
Mm-hmm.
Out of the country, just thought it was not a good thing to be there during a war.
Right.
But we actually didn't lose too many people if you think how many years we were there.
Mm-hmm.
Like 54, I think it was the first person we lost was in 54, 56.
Mm-hmm.
Back all the way to 75, we didn't lose too many people. We lost more people in a couple of years in Korea than we lost in 25 years in Vietnam or whatever it was.
Right. Okay.
Like 3 years, 21 years.
Okay. Well, thank you, sir.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
It very much. This will conclude our oral history interview with
yes.
Mr. Joseph Pizzo.